My guest, Jonathan Yardley, is a book critic and columnist for The Washington Post. In 1981, he won the Pulitzer Prize for Distinguished Criticism. Now the book critic is awaiting reviews of his own new book, a family memoir called Our Kind of People. It's a portrait of his parents, Bill and Helen Yardley. For 20 years, Bill Yardley was the headmaster of Chatham Hill, a Virginia boarding school for girls. Jonathan grew up in the school rectory with his brother and two sisters. Our Kind of People was favorably reviewed in the New York Times Sunday Book Review. Elizabeth Janeway described it as both a private act of piety and a public inquiry into the social history of the American minority known as WASPs. Janeway writes, "Out of lived experience and inherited legend, Yardley has made a fine book about all kinds of people." Yardley is also the author of a biography of Ring Lardner. I asked him if there are awkward moments for a book critic when their own book is reviewed.
Well, yes, because you've been on one side of the fence for your entire career, although in my case I did publish one book a dozen years ago. To suddenly be on the receiving end after being on the giving end is a strange phenomenon. I think that because you are a professional book reviewer, you're peculiarly sensitive to the way the business has been done and to the sort of the undercurrents of a book review. So I think you could say in candor that I've been watching the book review pages with unusual interest lately.
It must be tricky for book review editors to decide who should review you, because you've reviewed so many people that a lot of people would feel they owed you a favor, and a lot of other people would probably want to get even for a bad review.
That's exactly right, and I have seen 5 or 6 reviews of my book so far, and I'm relieved and pleased to say that they've all been favorable, and very few of them have been by people that I would have naturally thought of as prospective reviewers. So it suggests to me that book editors have been aware of this problem and have been thinking about it in a sensitive and productive way.
Does it give you a different sense of book reviewing to read reviews of your own work?
It makes you very much aware of how much a review of one's work can elevate or depress you. I'm a tough reviewer, and I will confess that in awaiting for the bad review that sooner or later is going to come of this book, I've thought of some of those those writers that I've been tough on, and I wouldn't change my judgments, not in a minute, but I sympathize with them more as human beings, perhaps, than I did when I wrote the reviews.
Well, let's talk about your new book, Our Kind of People. It's a memoir. It's the story of your parents, really, and through telling your parents' story, you also tell the story of other members of your family. This book started from you finding a cabinet of letters written by your parents. How did you find them?
Well, not long after my mother's death in the fall of 1986, I was visiting my father at their retirement cottage in Rhode Island. And my father was not in good physical or mental condition, and I had taken care of him, and he actually had a housekeeper, and she was putting him to bed. And I was sitting in the dining room and quite accidentally opened this little wooden file cabinet that I'd been aware of virtually all of my life, and it had always been locked. And there it opened up, and inside were very tightly packed 12 inches of letters, financial documents, health records, and other papers. I had seen family papers in the past, copies of my father's letters and other things, but I'd never seen them in so concentrated a dose. And I started reading through them that night, and I realized that here, with extraordinary detail, was the record of a 50-year marriage, and of parenthood and professional life and everything else. And I got to thinking that perhaps I could tell. I didn't think it then. It was a couple of months before it began to sink in, but slowly over a period of time, I began to feel that I had here the documentation to tell the story of the lives of some fairly ordinary middle-class American people. Not famous, not wealthy, not prominent. And it occurred to me that this was a story that might make connections with the lives of other fairly ordinary people. Whether that is in effect has happened, I don't really know. My parents were also white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and that enters into it. This is a story about the fading WASP culture and the kinds of people and convictions and traditions that it fostered.
I think one of the things that interests me the most about your book is your exercise in trying to find your parents' lives, the part of their lives that had nothing to do with the role of parenting.
Right.
We all know our parents as mother and father, mom and dad, but you tried to find what it is about your parents separate from their role as parents?
Well, there were two things I was trying to do there. First of all, I don't think I'm a particularly interesting person. I don't think I'd led a particularly interesting life that is interesting to anybody except me. And it never crossed my mind that a memoir of my own life would be of interest to anybody at all. So in thinking about this, the first thing I tried to do was to get myself out of the story as much as possible, except for certain places in which my appearance is unavoidable. The other thing was that I was 46 or 7 when I started working on this, started thinking about it, which is just about the same age as my parents were when they were in the prime of their lives. And I've had this, you know, I've had different experiences from theirs, but I've had children, I've had good moments and bad. I think matured into a reasonably adult person. And it occurred to me that I might be able to look through my own experience to see them as real people, not as parents. You know, parenthood is obviously tremendously important to all of those of us who are fortunate enough to be parents, but it's not the only thing we do in our lives, and it's our children tend to think that it is. And I tried to step back from my parents and to see them in whole.
You've even called them Bill and Helen in the book instead of mother and father.
Yes, I think that was very important. This was a way of saying to the reader that this is their book, not mine. And I think if every sentence had the phrase my mother or my father or my mother and my father, that I would have been intruding in there, even if I didn't mention myself, on every single line of the book, and I didn't want that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jonathan Yardley, book critic for The Washington Post, and author of a new memoir about his parents called Our Kind of People. Well, you keep saying that you don't think you're interesting enough to sustain a book, and you've taken yourself out of this memoir as much as possible. But I'm going to focus in for a moment on the section that you are prominently featured in. And this is the section where your father and mother have decided to send you to Groton, to the prep school. And I should point out here that your father was the rector of a girls' boarding school, or a girls' school that was partly a boarding school, in Virginia called Chatham Hall. You were something of a troublemaker at Groton, and the head of the school sent a letter complaining about your behavior to your father, and your father wrote a letter in response that I'd like for you to read.
It was on one of the numerous occasions when John Crocker, the head of Groton School, was on the verge of kicking me out, and my father responded to him as follows. It is easy to see what sort of boy Johnny must be at school. We have girls of that sort at Chatham Hall. They may not actually commit open crimes, but they nibble at the foundations of what the school is supposed to do. I am mortified that my son finds himself in this undistinguished company and pays back for his scholarship by unconstructive attitudes. Helen and I think that your talk with him was wonderful and that he is really determined to do well for the rest of the year. If you feel that he would be detrimental as a senior and does not deserve the chance, by all means act according to your best judgment. Do let me beg of you, however, to let us know as early as possible if you decide he should not return. It is very hard to get a boy into a halfway decent school for his final year, especially if he has been dropped by a first-class one. Let me beg of you, too, to follow him along a little bit and to lay it on the line in no uncertain terms. He has personally great respect for you, a respect colored by affection and a respect heightened by your conversation of December. It seems to me that education is a redemptive as well as a condemning process, and that we school people do not always solve our problems just by getting rid of them. I have got rid of many by the process you suggest for Johnny, and these children that I have dropped have stayed much longer on my conscience than the problems we kept and continued to work on.
What were your feelings when you first came across this letter and saw the trouble that you were making for your father?
I knew all along I was making trouble for my parents. Uh-huh. They were not shy about letting me know that. What really hit me then was, in seeing all of this on paper, was to see the strategies, which were really rather subtle, that my father had adopted in order to improve my chances of staying the course at Groton. There's an odd mixture of obsequiousness and pride in that letter, begging Crocker on the one hand to give me every possible chance, and on the other, being very stern with Crocker about saying, look, you can't use the school to shape this boy into what you think he ought to be. You've got to help him discover himself. Education is a redemptive as well as a punitive process.
Writing a book about your parents and seeing this letter from their perspective, Did you wish that at the time you were more careful about causing trouble for your parents?
Oh, no. I mean, life goes on as it goes. And, you know, it's I don't regret anything. That's I don't really have important regrets about anything in my life. All of us are going to have bad patches. And unfortunately, you can't have a bad patch all by yourself. Other people are going to be affected by it. I was very lucky that my parents, my mother in particular, were compassionate and kind to me when it really mattered. They were very, very frustrated, my father in particular, because he was himself a private school man. My misbehavior, which is really what it was, and my immaturity, which is certainly what it was, were very vexing to him. And he was very good with girls, but this difficult boy that he had was his oldest child, he couldn't always understand me, and he could be very impatient with me. And of course, I'm sorry for the grief I caused him at the time, but he and I ended up liking each other a good deal and as adults. And fathers and sons and mothers go through that.
What form did your rebelliousness take?
Well, I never have liked being in the classroom. I don't think that the schoolroom is the right place to learn, and not that I can offer you a better one. And I was just, I was very rebellious. My parents were inside, outside in the world of American privilege and prominence. They were old WASPs with a decent history running back into the country's early beginnings, but they never had any money together, and they worked for people who had a lot of money, who sent their daughters to Chatham Hall School and to other schools that my father had worked for previously. So I grew up with some resentments against people of privilege and money. And I think that I gave vent to them in a generally surly behavior for much of the time I was at Groton School. I was a bad boy. I had what schools like that call a bad attitude.
Your parents were very much involved with passing on certain values, the value of education, and the values of how to be, how to live properly. Is that the right way of putting it?
Well, I think so, yeah. How to live a life that isn't so completely self-absorbed and that somehow has some meaning and value for other people.
And, you know, running a school, they had to inculcate these values not only in their children, but in all the other parents' children that they were entrusted with. I wonder if that was handed down to you, if you as an adult feel also this sense of obligation in passing on certain values.
Well, that's a good question. Some friend of mine, a year or two ago, before I'd completed work on this book, I was telling him what I was doing and mentioning that my father had been a preacher of sorts, and he said, well, you know, you're a preacher of sorts too, and I think there's an element of truth to that. I don't work in the kind of people-centered environment that my father did. I work by myself in my study in my house in Baltimore doing book reviews in a weekly column that tends to be about social and cultural matters. And I'm sort of up there in my pulpit telling the world what I think, and I think of it as a way to give voice to the things that I believe in and the traditions that I hold to be valuable. And it's not, I think, as important a human activity as being a teacher, but it is a form of the same sort of thing.
Jonathan Yardley, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about book reviewing. And to kick off this chapter of our conversation, I'd like for you to read an excerpt of a letter that you reprint in your new memoir about your parents, Our Kind of People. And this is a letter from the head of the Groton School, the prep school that you attended, to your father. And it's about your behavior, and it's an analysis of you as a reader of books.
Well, this was in 1956, I guess. Yes, in the spring of 56. And once again, Groton School had been right on the edge of kicking me out, and once again, somehow or other, I had avoided the ultimate peril. And Crocker wrote to my father to say, Johnny has made sufficient progress to enable us to make a favorable decision as regards his return next year. And then he went on, it would be unrealistic to suppose that all his difficulties have been resolved. He is still a boy who lacks intellectual discipline. He reads a lot, but he reads superficially. And I hope very much that next year he will greatly increase his capacity to get the real substance out of a superior book. Incidentally, I hope that before long he will reach a stage of maturity beyond his present strong appetite for comic books.
Oh, who would have suspected? Well, how was that assessment? Do you think it was an accurate assessment?
Oh, absolutely.
For the time?
I think it was a little bit simplistic, but it took me a while to learn how to read a book right. And in those years, I wanted to read everything, and I was probably reading everything too hastily and not getting enough out of it.
Do you still read comic books?
I haven't seen a comic book for so long, I don't know what they look like anymore.
Okay. Let's talk about book reviewing. The first thing I want to ask you is about constructing a good book review and the function a good book review serves. And I'll mention here that there's a kind of book review that really drives me crazy. I call it the book report,
mm-hmm.
where the book reviewer sums up the story of the book, and this could be fiction or nonfiction, and then there's one equivocal sentence at the end
right.
in which you're trying to make out, does this mean they like it or not?
I think of those as the Time and Newsweek sort of book reviews. The magazines are better about that than they used to be, but it used to be that a book review in Time just consisted of a summary of what was inside the book with a sentence perhaps saying that this was a good book.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I hate those too. Let me offer the qualification that there is a certain kind of book review that performs a very valuable function, and that is a book review that takes the ideas or the information in a relatively arcane book, say on a book dealing with some new discoveries in science or some new social trends, a book that is not going to be widely read because it's difficult or obscure or whatever, but that contains important ideas. A book review, an intelligent book review that can encapsulate those ideas into 800 or 1,000 words and make them comprehensible to a serious general reader is a very valuable thing. Because that's probably the only way that those readers will ever encounter those ideas. But as a general rule, I think that it is a very valuable rule of thumb to tell as little about a book's contents as you can in order to describe the book to the reader.
And you think it's important, too, to state clearly what your impressions of the book are.
Absolutely. I mean, as in most things in life, books do not come in black and white. They tend to fall in varying shades of gray, so that in any book, you are going to find some good things and some bad things, and I think more often than not, book reviews, like everything else, are mixed. But that doesn't mean you have to equivocate. You can be strongly opinionated in saying, this is what I really like about this book, and this is where the author has failed.
I know those of us who work on Fresh Air are always in the position of going through books before we decide who our guests are going to be to see if we think that this book is worthy of an interview with the author.
Mm-hmm.
What's your technique for going through a book, not to review it, but to see if it's worthy of review?
Well, you know, I don't really work that way. I tend to make decisions on what books I will review before I've sat down with the book. I very, very rarely sit down with a set of bound galley proofs and read it and then say, oh, well, gee, I think I'll review this. It's much more a case of going through publishers' catalogs, of going through press releases, of seeing galley proofs that come in. You know, I've been doing this for 20 or 25 years, and I know who the experienced authors are whose work interests me. I know the subjects, the general subjects in nonfiction that I feel competent to review. I know books, what books each season are likely to be newsworthy. And if you work for a newspaper, as I do, and write book reviews for it, newsworthiness is an important consideration. I also have books suggested to me as possible items for review by members of the Washington Post's Book World staff. Sometimes I'm quite disappointed. I will commit myself 2 months in advance to reviewing a novel that looks particularly interesting for one reason or another, and I get to it and it isn't. But the reasons that made me go to it in the first place are likely to be strong enough so that the review still should be written. That is to say, this is an author whose work is interesting or a subject that's interesting or whatever. And even if the book disappoints me a great deal, I still think that that's a judgment that ought to be rendered.
About how many books do you have to review a week?
Well, I do 2 book reviews a week, and each is usually one book. Sometimes I double up, but I figure I review about 100 books a year.
How much time can you devote to reading each of the books that you review? Do you have time to actually read them?
Oh, yes.
Read them slowly?
Well, you know, I think that a book dictates the pace at which it's read. I am fully capable of reading a 600-page novel in a day if there's nothing particularly deep or arresting about the book. You know, a book that's the so-called proverbial good read, I can get through that very fast, at the rate of 100 pages an hour, and I'm taking in what I need to take in, and the review that I write will be competent and fair. But on the other hand, you can get a 150-page book, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, that's densely written, densely argued, or that's so wonderful that you don't want to rush through it. And that 150-page book can take me a day, too. There really are no... I set aside, for the two books I review each week, I set aside 2 days. I read on Tuesday and Wednesday, and I write my book reviews on Thursday, and I write my column on Friday. And Mondays, I'm in the Washington Post at a meeting. And 2 days, ordinarily, is plenty of time for me to read two books. And if it's not enough time, I make time. I have no objection to working on weekends if I need to do that. I'm going to be sitting down this week to read for the first time in 25 or 30 years The Grapes of Wrath, which has its 50th anniversary this spring. And that's a long book, and there's a little book, about 200-page book, of Steinbeck's notebooks on The Grapes of Wrath, and I'm going to be reviewing those together. I really very much doubt that I'll get through those in a day. That doesn't bother me. I'll allocate whatever time is necessary to do the job properly.
I'm sure following books as carefully as you do, that you always see patterns emerging about the kind of material being published or themes that emerge over a large body of work. Do you see that happening now, or the patterns that you see in the publishing world now?
I'm very worried about American literary fiction right now. I'm concerned that the schools of creative writing on the college campuses are isolating literary writers from real American life and are producing sort of cookie-cutter novelists whose books seem to me to have an astonishing isolation from life as most Americans actually live it. We see the good sort of upper middle brow fiction that people read when my parents were alive and reading by writers like Irwin Shaw and John Marquand and even Scott Fitzgerald and Thomas Wolfe, people whom we now think of substantial American literary figures. That kind of book that is connected with American daily life, you don't find that anywhere in this country in our literature now, except in pop fiction, bestseller type fiction. The so-called serious American fiction is very navel-gazing and self-conscious and almost hostile to the general, serious general reader. I find that a very, very disturbing development, because if literary American fiction becomes inward gazing, then if it doesn't look at any world except itself, then it's not going to connect with the world, and it'll eventually die on the vine.
I think some of the most interesting writing is happening in memoirs right now. You've just written one. I wonder what you think of that. I'm sure you've been reading
memoirs. I've read Tobias's book,
Tobias Wolff.
This boy's life, and I liked it. I particularly liked a book by Eva Hoffman called mm-hmm. Lost in Translation, and there are one or two others that I have not read Carl Bernstein's book, and there are one or two others I haven't written. My editor, John Herman at Weidenfeld and Nicholson, told me not so long ago that he thinks that the most interesting American writing is being done in nonfiction rather than in fiction, and I at the risk of being self-serving or sounding self-serving, I think that there's more than a small grain of truth to that.
Are there books recently where you found that you've taken a very unpopular stand, different from...
Well, I didn't like the Satanic Verses. Mm-hmm. My review of it appeared long before the furor over poor Rushdie's death sentence arose. I thought it was a tangled, self-indulgent, imitative, showy sort of book, and I have to tell you that although heaven knows my sympathy for Rushdie is absolute, my literary judgment of the book has not changed one iota, and I have sensed that a lot of people whose motives may or may not be pure, I guess it varies from individual to individual, who are so anxious to show their sympathy for Rushdie are making the mistake of confusing the author's plight with the literary quality of the book itself. Of course, the possibility that I am wrong is out there, as it always is, and I very often am wrong, but in this case, I've talked with a great many people about the Satanic Verses. I don't know anybody who's finished it.
Are there any book reviews you wish you could rewrite and reconsider your opinion?
Yeah, I don't think I will be kind and not mention any specifics, because there's no reason in singling out a very small handful of people. But by and large, they are books that I think I overpraised in the past. Books that came along on sort of a great rush of excitement, and I got caught up with them. I was younger then, and I'm probably more susceptible to that kind of temptation than I am now. I don't go out of my way to go against the grain, but I'm much more skeptical than I used to be about the kind of groundswell that builds up in publishing over such and such a book. And there are some very, very favorable reviews that I still see bouncing back at me in quotes on paperback dust jackets that I wish I hadn't written. I cannot think offhand of an unfavorable review I've written that I wished I had been kinder or more favorable.
Mm-hmm.
I write, you know, I read on Tuesday and Wednesday, as I say, and I write on Thursday. There isn't an awful lot of time, obviously, for reflection. It's not much different from the theater critic who goes to the performance at 8 and gets back to the office at 11 and has his copy in by midnight. There's not much time for the luxury of prolonged meditation and reflection that the so-called literary critic has. Given that you don't have much time, you're going to make mistakes. And given that most work isn't very good, the mistakes tend to be to get too excited about something that seems more wonderful than it really is. That, at least to me, is the principal problem I face.
When you go on vacation, do you enjoy taking a book with you, or do you
yes,
give yourself
I do.
A break?
Yes, I do. I went through a few summers when I couldn't stand to have a busman's holiday, but last summer I took the Library of America, Edith Wharton, and I took some Theodore Dreiser, and I took some Josephine Tay, and I guess what you could say is I took really, really good books to the beach and didn't have to worry about reviewing them, and I just had the time of my life. I hadn't read all of the Wharton and Dreiser, who are writers I admire enormously, and this was a real treat for me. After reading a lot of mediocre books by people who are grinding them out now, it was a real joy to read something that had lasted for a long time.
Well, Jonathan Yardley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your new book and about reviewing books. Thank you.
Well, my pleasure.